there's a project that my company is actually working on in the moment for a new mine on the West Coast, which is due to connect to the network. Quite a big load. We're talking about probably almost doubling the West Coast's electrical load with this one Bitcoin mine, which is a pretty big deal when you think about it. This is, to me, is just super exciting because, you know, I see this massive potential with, you know, Bitcoin mining paired with new generation sources, solar, wind, that type of thing, and they're just so complementary.
Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. In this episode, I talk with Brad Henderson, a power system engineer and head of engineering and design at Electronet, a New Zealand-owned consultancy firm. Brad shares some exciting details about a new Bitcoin mining facility that his firm has been involved with on the west coast of New Zealand. We discuss what energy sovereignty might mean for New Zealand, including the importance of electrifying the economy, and how Bitcoin mining and solar power may help create energy abundance. If you would like to support the show and my work, please consider leaving a review on your favorite podcasting app, or tipping some Bitcoin to the show's wallet. Otherwise, pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. If you have any questions or feedback, please reach out. My emails are always open, hello@thetransformationofvalue.com. Otherwise, on to the show.
Brad, how have you been?
Pretty well, actually. I've just had one of those crazy days. I'm actually in Auckland, at our Auckland office. I've came up on the 5:45 and interviews and meetings all day, and just got back from another coffee date with a potential new colleague. And yeah, it's been a bit hectic, and I'm just running on coffee.
Yeah. Well, no worries. Well, hopefully we'll make this into a relaxing and enjoyable conversation. In fact, you sent through some things to discuss, a couple of notes. So you actually did my job for me as well, which is kind of awesome. But it sounds like there's been some awesome developments since we last caught up on the show last year around what the work you're doing with renewable energy in New Zealand, and maybe some of the broader things that you're seeing around Bitcoin mining and the opportunities for that in New Zealand. So I guess, where do you want to start, man?
Oh, good question. I think, you know, let's start with the Bitcoin mining piece, because I think that's something that I'm pretty passionate about, and sort of segues into that energy sovereignty piece, I think, quite nicely. So I mentioned to you that there's a project that I actually still can't talk about it because it's still confidential, but there's a project that my company is actually working on in the moment for a new mine on the West Coast, which is due to connect to the network. Quite a big load. We're talking about probably almost doubling the West Coast's electrical load with this one Bitcoin mine, which is a pretty big deal when you think about it. This is, to me, is just super exciting because, you know, I see this massive potential with, you know, Bitcoin mining paired with new generation sources, solar, wind, that type of thing. And they're just so complementary. And I think we're just early days getting into exploring this potential.
Yeah, well, I mean, since we last spoke as well, I've continued to grow my interest in mining. I think there's, you know, being outside of New Zealand, looking back in, I think there's some real challenges that the country is going through at the moment. And I think a lot of them can come back to two things, really, or maybe one thing, but certainly the money. And then secondly, the infrastructure. You know, it's this kind of long island, this mountainous, you know, geoactive island of New Zealand. And within that, though, there is a lot of opportunities. And so I'm kind of hopeful for the future at how Bitcoin mining can play a role in this kind of new New Zealand, which I think we will begin to, I think I'm hoping it begins to emerge in the coming years, because things aren't really looking that good at the moment, man, to be honest. Like, you've got issues with roads, you've got issues with power, you've got issues with, you know, cost of living. And I don't want to see New Zealand go backwards, you know? And so that's where I
100%
sort of bringing the we back into it, you know, I think a national conversation around what we want to do there, and then people sort of stepping up and doing it, which sounds like you're involved with some of that work. And I mean, we do know that already there is some Bitcoin mining taking place in New Zealand, and it's renewable, sustainable. It's an export industry, right?
I mean, I just love this concept of thinking about, buying your sats and getting them, and it's come from, a local. I know Bitcoin's, the whole concept of it is a global interconnected thing, but it's still very nice to have that local connection to thinking about where your sats might have come from, and if New Zealand can get to a place where we're mining more than there's demand for sats internally, I mean, that would be awesome. I think we're nowhere near there yet, right?
Well, I think there's a couple of pieces here. So one, you'd be familiar with how payouts work and the current mining pool structure. And I think we're seeing some challenges and some disruptions to mining pools, which are arguably the most centralized part of Bitcoin at the moment. However, there's a few things that are emerging. Are you familiar with Ocean Pool?
I'm not actually, no.
No, so I mean, most people when they think of Bitcoin mining, when talking to miners, that they're talking about something like Brains, Luxor, one of these sort of major pools that anyone can join. But the problem is you don't get to choose the block template. You're generally relying on their payout schedules and their honesty to tell you what is your Bitcoin.
Sure.
And so there is kind of a criticism that maybe you're a hasher, you're not a miner per se. You're just sort of renting your hash rate. With something like Ocean Pool, there is this opportunity where it is sort of programmatically done, and so there's no way to kind of take transaction fees and kind of hide what you're paying out to the individual workers and the individual miners, and also you how would you say the model of payouts, which is around regular payouts, every day, every couple of hours or whatever, that changes, right? When you're on a system like that, it's only whenever your pool gets a block, but when it does get a block, you get your honest percentage of that block. But that kind of framework, coupled with Lightning payouts, I think could really feed into the vision you just described of New Zealanders buying New Zealand mined Bitcoin, where the small miners, people like myself or larger operations, could sell that Bitcoin locally in very small amounts, even if they need to. Sort of. 5,000 satoshis, even whatever a small amount you want to go for, directly into over Lightning, and then that can also get brought locally through something like Lightning Pay, which is a startup that's actually come out of New Zealand recently doing
I was
Lightning
just
based.
listening to your
Oh
podcast,
yeah,
actually, the latest one that's dropped right this morning, actually, and learning about that, which is
yeah.
quite cool, isn't it? Yeah.
So I'm Brad. I'm very bullish on how Lightning and that connection with the mining side means, it's not this kind of long-winded process where it can be very much like a daily sale, or hourly or whatever it needs to be, straight onto the market and then brought straight from the market with very low fees, especially as we, if we see high transaction fees potentially. But anyway, that's just sort of a segue on sort of what I'm seeing.
Cool. No, it's and I'm getting sidetracked a little bit, but I'm interested in how do you sort of see the landscape at the moment in terms of the I guess the zeitgeist of Bitcoin? I mean, you're pretty close to it, and obviously there's a bit of froth around at the moment with the halving coming up and that kind of stuff, and it's pumped in the markets and all that. And do you think we're getting a bit more cut through with people understanding, or people being orange pilled, so to speak, and understanding the depth of Bitcoin rather than just the, oh, here's another asset boom bust thing going on?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think the ETFs and number go up have had a huge impact. Basically, there's a psychological mechanism where when it suddenly does start mooning, which it has in the last couple of months, I mean, we've all been, diamond hands for many years now through the bear market. However, when the number does actually start go up and it starts getting some mainstream news coverage, there's just a psychological switch. And I know a lot of people have told me they've got people starting to come to them now, talking about Bitcoin, long lost friends starting to say, hey, that Bitcoin you gave me 2 years ago, that little, that little demo wallet you set up, how can I get it? At the same time, you got people selling as well. They're finally maybe back in the black, I guess, in terms of their fiat value. So I'm very bullish on the future, and where we're at the moment. How it affects the mining side, I'm not sure yet. I think we're in a good price position where even if the halving happens at this price point, I don't think it's going to be like, is not going to be as significant as if we were, back where we were, a year ago or whatever. So
I mean, that's the idea behind the halving, right? Is that you should expect the price to the fiat price of Bitcoin to go up, right?
Yeah.
To match that reward, so that the miners are still getting a fair reward for their work, right?
Yeah, and look, I mean, I actually have just been working on an article. I've been having some high level conversations with, you know, just sort of by virtue of doing the podcast, a lot of people reach out to me and just sort of privately having conversations with people about mining and what it means, kind of from a maybe from an investment perspective. Not that I give investment advice, but you know, sort of like what do you need to know? What's the explain like I'm five of Bitcoin mining? And I think people are starting to really look at some of the stuff that's getting stood up in Texas and other parts of the world. These like actual, you know, facilities, you know, these aren't just guys in their backyard. These are proper, you know, data centers. And there's an argument to be said that that's an unsustainable business model as well. I think a lot of people are asking very, you know, very pointed questions about what it all means. You know, can you have, you know, 10,000 machines in one data warehouse? You know, is that a threat actually to the network if it goes offline, if it gets captured? Yep. And a lot of these large miners, you know, they are captured in the sense they've got shareholders, they've got, you know, think processes they have to go through, whereas the guy in his backyard is just, you know, doing what he wants. So it's an ecosystem, I guess, at the end of the day, of different players.
Yeah, and I think you'll see, you know, like any ecosystem, you see that development of all kinds of different people bringing mining projects to bear. Like you'll see the mum and pop operation, like yourself, basically with a S9 in the corner heating up your living room, right through to these, you know, giant conglomerates and stuff. And I think that's the beauty of Bitcoin, right? Is it gives space for scalability of all sizes, and I just love that about it. It's this low barrier to entry.
Yeah,
away you go, and it all it asks of you is you do a bit of work, right, just to think about it and understand what it all means. And to me, that's the power of it.
Yeah, a little bit of proof of work. And one thing that's probably worth mentioning, so I've had a couple of conversations recently going deeper into the mining story and kind of what it really means, and starting to I've invested a little bit more into my fleet, I guess you could say, and sort of what I'm doing. And one of the things that you mentioned to me was how Bitcoin, it's converting energy directly into currency, right? And I'm beginning to wonder what the paradigm shift looks like when you start having energy priced in Bitcoin. Is that something you've thought about at all?
Well, yeah, totally. And I think it already is, right? Because, I mean, you can, simplistically, you can look at Satoshis and almost do the direct translation from kilowatt hours into Satoshis, right? It's almost, and I think longer term, that's where I see how the value of Bitcoin will be measured in terms of energy. At the moment, people still tag it to fiat, right? But how do you come up with a real world value for Bitcoin when there's no fiat around, right? Say that it is the reserve currency in the world, right? And there's no fiat. How do you value it? I think energy seems to me like the logical way to do it, because you can always go, well, I know how many kilowatt hours it takes me to heat up my room on a cold winter's night. I know the value of that. And you can translate that back. And I think, and there's a lot, you know, everybody uses electricity all the time for everything. We're only getting more of it, needing more and more of it all the time. And I just love that. To me, that interconnectivity and that exchangeability, almost one-to-one relationship, as I see it, between energy and Bitcoin.
Yeah, the sort of five-dimensional chess that I've been playing. I did an episode a couple of weeks back with a guy, Brett Scott, and I had a lot to think about. He definitely challenged some of my views around money, and he gave me some insight. And then I felt I needed to learn more about what he was talking about when it came to credit theories of money. And I've recently started reading Lynn Alden's Broken Money. Are you familiar with that book?
I'm not actually, no.
It's a really good complement to like the Bitcoin Standard by Saifedean.
Yep.
But yeah, I'm working through that. And, you know, she does a really good job of basically consolidating ledger theories of money with kind of commodity theories of money, and how, you know, the fiat and gold and sort of traditional sound money ideas, how it all connects. And traditionally, there's been two schools of thought. And when I did the episode with Brett, he certainly challenged me on that. He sort of gave me some questions around, you know, what is money, you know, why, you know, what would commodity theory of money thinking, how would commodity theory of money thinking kind of color your views on something like Bitcoin? But as a synergy, I think, of commodity and ledger, it sort of got me a lot. It got me really thinking about sort of, well, what underpins that that flow and that network. And so, just to go on a little bit of a segue here, but mm-hmm. sort of the this idea when it comes to something like modern monetary theory, which is quite
the source of all our problems, right?
Yeah. Well, so as a framework, I absolutely don't, you know, I disagree with it as a prescription, but as a framework, I think it actually does explain to an extent how money comes into being. You know, you have to, you know, you demand it for tax. And so somehow you have to get your hands on fiat to pay your tax obligations, right?
Yep.
And I think taking that framework and sort of, and I haven't fully done the work on this, but I feel like there's a way of transposing that onto energy, where in a way, when you're Bitcoin mining, there's nothing else you can do with that energy. You've spent it, right? There are some use cases in arbitrage with heat and waste heat usage, I think, sure. But for the most part, that energy gets spent. And that is a form of, it's a form of debt, right? You've indebted that energy. You've encumbered the network with that energy that's now gone. And so it then sort of makes its way through the system, and you have to spend some of that Bitcoin for transaction fees to then use your Bitcoin. And I haven't fully worked out how this works, but I think there is a relationship there that maybe mirrors some of our thinking around credit theories of money, where it is the miners and that use of energy that peg into proof of work and that peg into the real world that just makes the whole thing go round, if that sort of makes sense. You know, it's not just magical ledger money that someone's like willed into existence. It requires you to actually lay on the table some actual kilowatt hours and spend them on something that cannot really be used for anything else to any degree, right?
Yeah, and I think if we're talking about mainstream acceptance of Bitcoin and to get real cut through, which I think is what a lot of people would like. Myself, I consider myself one of those people that I think, you know, there's value in it having some mainstream appeal. It has to be translatable into a little bit, something a bit more tangible that people can understand, right? Because if you just try and explain to them cold, here's this new money, the first question you get is, well, what's wrong with the credit card in my wallet, right? Why do I need a new form of money? And then you go down the rabbit hole of what is sound money and all that, like you said. But if you can sort of point to something about, well, you know, this is money that's backed by the Clyde Power Station. You know, we're producing money out of water that's running through a dam. You know, it means something to people, I think. Then, you know, they really feel that it's got a backing in something real in the world, which I really like.
Well, coming back to your sort of example, you know, how much heat does it take to warm up a cold room or something? I think going a bit further than that and understanding this kind of fundamental narrative of energy as the base resource of society and civilization. And there's this classic essay, The Use of Knowledge in Society, which is sort of the foundational Austrian economics text on how, you know, the price of a pencil or some commodity encompasses all of this knowledge and implicit kind of understanding of how much value is in that item from its supply and demand side. And all of the work that went into developing the thing, it can be summarized in that single number, which is the price, right? And there's a lot of other Austrian essays and Austrian economics people looking at that place. But the problem is, you fundamentally mess with that when you start having inflationary money that can just be printed, right? But tying it back to energy, and you know, you use energy, factories use energy, transportation energy, it's all connected,
everything.
And then the fact that the pricing unit can also be in that same thing. So you've got Satoshis measuring the energy, but then they are the price, and it just compresses down into the singular unit that is the SAT. And that's like, you know, mind blowing. You know, we're no longer sort of operating with these two sort of different things that are trying to meet each other. It is just one unit for everything.
Yeah, I could make, I'm just thinking out loud now and making a case for using SATs and all my engineering calculations now is as the unit instead of kilowatt hours.
Yeah, well, it also globalizes it as well. So you've got power can be generated somewhere. It can be turned into this digital energy, which is a classic trope now at this point, digital energy. But then it can be redeployed somewhere else. And for example, in Japan, right? Energy poor country. There's a bit of nuclear here, but they're importing oil. But a lot of manufacturing going on here. And you've got issues around that supply, demand. You've got OPEC, you've got pricing of oil. It's all very messy. And if you've got a unit for that, that is maybe clearer, less noise in the pricing of energy. I can see that actually enhancing your ability to manufacture and plan capital investments, perhaps. I don't know how that works geopolitically, but you've got these cartels who can set the price, and it's all connected back to the petrodollar, the US sort of hegemony.
Yep.
It's kind of messy, and I don't know how it all works, but it seems like Bitcoin's the simple solution to a lot of those issues.
Yeah, and in my experience, in the long run, the simple solution is what generally wins in the long run if it makes sense. And the old kind of saying is in politics, right? Is if you're explaining, you're losing. I think that sort of applies as much as I'm loath to use politics as an example for how we should operate in the world. But it's there's a lot of power in simple ideas, I think, and at the heart of that energy Bitcoin relationship, I think, is a simple idea which is quite powerful.
Yeah, well, I mean, along those lines, I was having another conversation earlier today just around AI and high performance compute, and the sort of comment was how much more energy is going to be required for HPC and just running these AI training algorithms and stuff. And I thought, well, look, that's actually a really good thing. Because it means we get to build more power stations and we get to build more AI. And that narrative hasn't quite trickled down yet, I don't think.
One interesting thing that I've observed with the AI movement, because it's quite interesting to track it. It's been, another big buzz thing that's sort of taken over the world in the past couple of years. And I've observed, there's a few people that will point out, oh, gee, aren't we worried about all the energy use, right? That's, global warming, carbon emissions, all that kind of thing to do with AI. Not too many people say that about AI, but, it's almost the first thing, the first criticism you get about Bitcoin, right? Is that, oh, what about all the, coal plants in China that are mining the Bitcoin? It's the people. And, again, that understanding that the energy use in the Bitcoin network is a feature, not a bug. And I think that's a really important concept that not everybody took me a while to grasp that as well. I was on the camp of, this energy use, how can this thing's surely going to die because it's just so wasteful, right? To spend all this money just hashing away. But to understand that concept that actually that's so important for the security and the value in that network is a key concept that I love about the, Bitcoin ecosystem.
Yeah, and I mean, it got me thinking, again, this is still a sketch that I'm sort of working on, but it got me thinking about, you've got fractional reserve banking, full reserve banking, these kind of ideas. And when it comes to energy use, what in a hyper-Bitcoinized world where, power, electricity, everything's priced in Satoshis, or it's underwritten by, by Bitcoin at scale, what percentage of energy would be used on mining? And I'm wondering, if there's actually a calculation there where every unit that is in the economy is sort of underwritten by a kilowatt hour being used in the mining side, and they sort of match each other, and there's a kind of full reserve energy kind of a concept going on. I don't quite know how that would work. It's still just an idea that I think about in the shower now, but it's sort of, would it match on one-to-one where economic growth and sort of the entire economy is pegged to this kind of, there's a clear connection between the growth of hash rate, the growth of energy production, and, the world, I guess.
Oh, I think, you can draw a lot of parallels or lessons from history with that to say that, whenever we've managed to unlock more energy, it's meant more prosperity for society, basically. So, I, you know, to I only see the hash rate energy use going up, but you know, you've got all these parallel uses of energy as well. Wherever we make more of it, we find more uses for it. You know, the AI is a classic example. So I can't see a world where the mining becomes more than even a double digit percentage of world energy use. I'd find that very interesting if it ever got that far. I think energy generation and energy production will grow at least as fast as the mining network grows.
Yeah, well, I mean, along those lines, maybe we need to workshop on this or something, man. But like, I was just working through these concepts of like my own personal sovereignty of how much hash that I have in my custody. I've been looking at, okay, well, how much has the global hash rate increased since I got that first machine? And then how do I need to match my current sort of ratio, I guess you could say. And these kinds of questions, and I they're just sort of provocations at this point, but you know, what do I need to do to stay competitive and keep my sort of percentage of hash rate, because that is continuing to grow. And what I've seen is it's actually growing at such a speed that I could see a world where it is, you know, every kilowatt that's used in, you know, the productive economy, sort of quote unquote, is actually matched by a kilowatt being used for mining, or some ratio, that some sort of connection. And that would be very interesting, because then you've got this whole new kind of metric for measuring growth, because, you know, GDP is often used, right? But that's a very messy, loose way to measure, because it you know, it doesn't take into account the way the dollar has devalued over time.
Well, the classic example is that, you know, when there's a vandal goes through a city smashing all the windows, it actually puts GDP up, right? Because the windows all have to be repaired, lawyers get involved, police get involved, and all of a sudden GDP's gone up, but actually society's gone backwards because we've got a whole bunch of broken windows.
Yeah.
So yeah, I love the idea of defining another way to define societal progress. I think, with, you know, and tying it to hash rate or something like that, would, or some derivative of hash rate, if it's not hash rate itself, I think that could be really powerful.
Yeah, and I mean, if all things work, you know, well, all things are connected, right? And so in your example there, the window gets smashed, a piece of energy, you know, some resource needs to be spent to go and fix that window. Theoretically, a hyper-Bitcoinized world would say that actually means some hash rate comes offline, because some, you know, somewhere in the chain, you know, there's maybe sort of resources that are then being spent elsewhere. And there's a, you know, you wouldn't be able to match it straight through, but there would be an aggregate effect. Similar to say, you know, if there's a war, you know, your productive economy, your factories go offline, right? Or they get diverted to producing things that are no longer productive, you know, producing
cruise missiles.
Cruise missiles and sending them over to the Middle East. But I guess along those lines, just come back sort of quickly to the AI piece. So I just was chatting to someone about this, and there's certainly the political angle. You know, I feel like AI is a lot more kosher. You know, people can talk about AI in the halls of parliament and not get the funny look. But when they talk about Bitcoin, as you know, I think that's changing slowly. But I was having another talk about AI with somebody, and you know, they said to me, AI is going to put us back to work. And I guess what the intention of that comment was, is that, I mean, I'm sure you've had a play with it, but some of the busy work and just the bullshit we have to do in our fiat lives, AI just can take it and do it. All right, you got to write an email, you got to do a spreadsheet, whatever. And what I'm really interested in is the work you're doing with ElectroNet, and you know, this kind of physical, real world work, and how sort of innovation and the kind of future lies at the intersection of this digital and physical world. Because anything that's just purely digital, it's going to get evaporated away. It's going to be free, zero cost. AI is just going to do it. But it's still, someone has to do the work to put the power stations into the ground, right? So how do you see those two connecting?
Yeah, this is a big topic, and one that I'm quite interested in and passionate about, with this kind of, it's related to that, will AI steal all my jobs, right? Steal all our jobs kind of piece. And I think you're absolutely right that the potential for it to take away the drudgery in a lot of professional services roles. Amazing, you know, like a good chunk of my day is spent, you know, processing email, organizing meetings, that kind of thing. Just, you know, what is essentially admin type work. And AI can unlock. I've seen some pretty amazing demos. I think Copilot from Microsoft, not to name drop things, is pretty much already there with a lot of this stuff in terms of the ability to take that away from you. And that just, to me, that's just so exciting because it just unlocks, you know, the potential for your creative people to work on, like you say, real world problems, actually work on deploying these solar farms, deploying these wind farms, building out the infrastructure that we need to complement those massive projects, which is can be a bit of a forgotten piece, especially with, you know, I think we talked about it a little bit last time when we were with Mike talking about that, the importance that the grid plays in linking all these energy sources together. And, you know, to sort of come full circle on that, you know, if AI allows us to be more effective and more productive in our work, it just accelerates that transition. We can get these projects online quicker. We can complement them with Bitcoin mines to help pay for them, because essentially that's at the moment where I see a little bit of a barrier in the industry is, and I think you had Blair Walter on to talk a little about this a while ago, you know, you've got to get these projects across the line, these big, you know, these are mega scale infrastructure projects for New Zealand, you know, talking hundreds of millions, in some cases over $1 billion worth of infrastructure in order to build these projects. And a billion's not what it used to be, but thanks to inflation. But you know, you need someone to essentially underwrite that project, right? And the way that you underwrite an energy project is you need someone to buy the energy, basically. And if you don't have that buyer, then your project's dead in the water, basically. And in New Zealand, we're a small economy with not a lot of large industrial capacity. You know, we've got TY as one big example, and, you know, a handful of other large energy users, but not a huge manufacturing economy. And in order to get these projects viable, you know, having something like a Bitcoin mine to, if not underwrite the whole project, because that's probably unrealistic, but to underwrite a portion of that project, it just could be the difference between, you know, getting some of these projects across the line or having them languish and not be developed. So it's sort of changed topic a little bit, but that's that, you know, AI is an enabler for some of these things.
Yeah, well, thank you. I guess I am aware that there is a narrative, you know, there's kind of the AI hype wagon, you know, and I'm certainly in the critical camp that sort of looks and says, oh, you know, there's kind of LinkedIn soy boys talking about how AI is going to do this and that. But actually what I think we're seeing happen just in the free market, or in the market, it's maybe not free, but, you know, we've got massive restructuring of government. And government, if you want to talk about drudgery, the public service, the public sector, you know, it is a drudgery all day, every day. And those jobs are going. Those people are out of work because it's not sustainable. And I think AI, just even a percentage, I know there is a percentage value that already has for just day-to-day jobs. You know, I've used it to help me with coding, helping doing documents. I mean, you've used it. It's not 100% or anything, but there's certainly a number where that is certainly making a difference. And so I see that increasing over time. And I'm much more excited now, even personally, around when coming back to the physical world, you know, looking at the mining side, looking at what I can do in my local community, what I can do around me. This kind of idea that we're all going to be sort of just digital, hyper connected online, I think that basically trends to zero. You know, there's no, it's kind of like the news, you know, no one pays for news anymore. You have to be doing something else. And I think where that comes in is the real world, you know, shovel-ready work in the ground. And I think New Zealand needs it, man.
Yeah, I think we, somewhere along the lines of the last, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 years, we sort of lost our way in what we value as a society a little bit. And I think this is not unique to New Zealand, though, by the way. I mean, they've got similar problems in the US as well, just to, and the UK. I know, you know, infrastructure is a problem because it's not sexy. It's not sexy to build infrastructure. It was sexy to build a new motorway, but it's not sexy to maintain your existing motorways or your existing transmission lines, or because your politician can't point to these things and say, look what I've done. You know, look what I've enabled. I've enabled this pothole to be repaired. And that doesn't seem to have a lot of cut through, but yeah, somehow we've got to find a mechanism to place more value on looking after what we have and looking after it well. But also, like you say, to have a bit of vision on how we can improve what we've got for the next generation as well and leave it in a better space.
Yeah. Well, I think there is a vision. I was talking to Matthew Birchall about it. He's sort of, you know, fostering a culture of building again. You know, New Zealand has always had this DIY kind of get it done attitude. But I think that has been subverted just with big government and this kind of, you know, paradigm shift in the role of the nanny state, which kind of was always there. But, you know, I think I look around me, you know, when I'm in Asia and I look at just the depth of infrastructure, you know, there's bullet trains and there's high voltage power lines everywhere, there's concrete and it's not necessarily beautiful in the sense of natural beauty, but man, New Zealand at a base layer, there's not much there. You know, the floods really showed that to me firsthand. It's like, man, Japan, even China, different places I've traveled to, it's like there's so much infrastructure, so much layers of infrastructure. And then what that enables, the network effect of being able to have factories that are connected to this and then connected to that. You can go from one end of the country to the other on a 300 kilometer an hour train, you know. And
yep, it's a multiplier. Infrastructure is a multiplier, right? It levels up everything in your economy. And, you know, historically in the, you know, 50s and 60s, and earlier, governments saw that as their function was to build, to help enable these types of infrastructure projects that they could see were going to level up the economy. And for some reason, you know, we've sort of, like you say, sort of lost our way a little bit, and not quite understanding that one-to-one. Look, you know, maybe there's so many factors here. It's kind of hard to untangle. You know, it's the, you know, the Twitter soundbite culture plays a role too in it, right? And you know, the lack of deep thinking at times. And yeah, it's a real bird's nest of causes and effects and things.
Well, yeah, and again, so I don't definitely don't want to come off like I'm shitting on New Zealand too much, because I think we've been given you know, that we've inherited this situation and it's up to people like us to actually, you know, fix it, right?
Totally. Yeah.
And so that's why, you know, I am going, you know, going all in on this idea that I think Bitcoin, Bitcoin mining in particular, those two pieces at a policy kind of leadership level actually are critical, right? And it needs to kind of connect with a grassroots movement as well. But another thing you, I guess, what this connects to with what you messaged to me earlier around energy self-sovereignty. So what does this mean for New Zealand? Because it feels like energy sovereignty and infrastructure are sort of very much connected, right?
Yeah, it's a great segue. I'm quite passionate about climate change. I think we touched on that, and you know, getting us to a place where we're not just pumping out carbon to meet our energy needs. And we've got a heck of a long way to go in the world to get to that space. And to take New Zealand as a case study, right? You know, we are importing, I don't know how many. I'm not going to quote a number because I'll be wrong. I haven't done my research prior, but thousands, hundreds of millions of barrels of oil every year, right, to power our vehicles and our economy and move our goods and services around the country. And that all comes from overseas. You know, we used to have a little bit of, we still do, I think, have a little bit of petroleum production, but it's pretty minor compared to how much we consume. So we are, you know, reliant on huge tankers coming in from overseas with all this refined product. And it, you know, you just talked about this veneer of civilization that we have in New Zealand with our infrastructure. But, you know, you think about our ports and, you know, we rely on these ships bringing the fuel to come in to keep this economy running at the moment. And if a bad earthquake happened and took out a few of our ports, we'd be in a real bad space with trying to get fuel to run our economy, and the country would just grind to a halt overnight. So what I like about self-sovereignty and getting more electricity is that we make all our own electricity. We make it locally. We have to import the solar panels and the wind turbines and things, but once you have that infrastructure, it's there for 20, 30, 40 years. And it keeps generating electrons the whole time. During that time, it's not reliant on that next tanker coming in from overseas that is vulnerable to terrorism, is vulnerable to weather events, all those kind of things. So to me, self-sovereignty is about just increasing, doubling down, going hard on electrifying our economy, getting massive infrastructure, building these big energy projects so that we can be more reliant on electricity to minimize our fuel consumption, because I see that as our huge Achilles heel at the moment, is all this fuel that we're importing and we don't have local supplies.
Well, I mean, along those lines, I mean, I think there's a certain geopolitical awareness or sort of way of thinking that is challenging in New Zealand because it is so remote. And I was, I was back there for a couple of years, and I just, when you're on the island, you're on the island, and the rest of the world's very far away, and someone is organizing things and they come on the boat. However, I think looking at it from the perspective of Japan, which is a similar sort of geography, it's island, geoactive, earthquakes all the time. Also not really super, in terms of hydrocarbons, it's not self-sovereign, it needs to import. The way they've solved this is with nuclear. And it's quite profound. Like, as I said before, just the depth of, the layers of paint of infrastructure here, the depth of infrastructure anywhere I look around me, no matter how far you are in the countryside, there's concrete pylons, there's reinforced banks of cut through mountains, they've cut through, rivers, they've built highways over the top of things just to make sure that the entire country is connected and functioning as an economy. Whereas all it takes is a little bit of rain and the east coast of New Zealand is cut off, which is actually quite freaky, man. And we managed to get through, but how much, we basically cut down to the bone when that happened.
We're going to get more of these events, right? All the science is telling us that. The next one might not be as bad. We might get lucky again, but we've got the revolver with one loaded chamber, right? And we keep spinning it and hoping that it keeps coming up blank, right? And at the moment, we don't know when that full chamber is going to line up and take out the country in some more severe way. And I'll be the first person to hope that it never does. And that's what this conversation is partly about, right? Is it sort of a motivation to get on and do the work and make us more resilient, which I think is something that we can hope for, and hope Bitcoin to me is an enabler of that resilience piece.
Well, I guess along those lines, I'm keen to dive into the energy piece a little bit, and then I've got some other topics here. But when it comes to solar, now this is something, there is some discussion about this, sort of in the Bitcoin space more broadly, around what the value proposition is of renewables. I think a certain narrative that maybe solar isn't actually what it's all hyped up to be, but you write about this a lot, you talk about this a lot. So I mean, how do you see solar, maybe wind as well, fitting into the picture, and sort of how does it all work together?
Great question. I'm a super solar bull, I suppose, is
solar maximalist.
I've been on the solar train a lot longer than I've been on the Bitcoin train, actually. I put panels on my house in Melbourne back in 2012, I think it was. And Australia was like quite a few things. They're sort of about 10 years ahead of us in some of these things. What we've seen, if I start with the solar, I'll touch on wind in a minute, but in the solar space, what we've seen over the past, well, it's really been a story of the past 40 years, or even longer ago if you follow the research back, but we've seen this dramatic reduction in cost for the panels basically themselves. And if you're trying to build a large infrastructure project, or even a small infrastructure project like solar, the panels still make up the majority of the cost of the project. It's in the vicinity of you know, 30 to 40% of that project cost. But what we keep seeing is decade over decade or year over year, even this price keeps falling. Even in, you know, our inflationary times and our mega inflationary times, that we had a little bit of a stop of the reductions during, say, 21, 22. But in the last year or two, it's resumed its downward trajectory. There's a concept called Wright's Law, which applies to a lot of these kind of technologies in the space, where basically every time you double the production of a certain item, it falls in price by a certain percentage. And solar, depending on what you read and what research you look, has got a price reduction rate of sort of 30% for every doubling of production. And that's pretty amazing. So, you know, it's must be about 1/10 of the cost of it was, you know, 10 or 15 years ago in terms of the panel cost. So to me, I just see this, the way I see this playing out is that it just gets more and more dominant in the energy space as a way of producing energy, because, you know, we talked about it earlier in the conversation, going to zero, effectively how it plays out in the energy space is the cost of energy, you know, goes towards zero because of the low cost of solar. And it will never go quite to zero, because you're always going to have some fundamental cost for the underlying infrastructure, for, you know, the labor, the expertise that goes into building it. But it's going to bottom out. It's still a long way from bottoming out. It's going to bottom out at a very low value. And, you know, we touched on this as well earlier in the conversation. Whenever we find more abundant sources of energy in the world, we find ways of using them. And so it just unlocks, when energy becomes cheaper, it just unlocks more uses of that energy. So what I see playing out because of the influence of solar over the next decade is a real downward pressure on electricity prices, which might come as a bit of a shock to some people who keep paying bigger and bigger power bills. But I think we're on the cusp of seeing some profound change in the electricity space in terms of cost. And yes, there are some issues that need to be worked through. You know, the obvious one that people always talk about with solar is that, you know, you don't get much solar generation when it's nighttime, and it's very true. But in complement to that, solar generation is an incredible price performance reduction also in batteries. So you're going to have this beautiful kind of interlinked virtuous cycle where solar gets cheaper, batteries are getting cheaper. People are like, okay, well, let's, you know, and we're already seeing it in the energy space. Most solar projects now, not so much in New Zealand, but in Australia, US, they get paired with a battery. And so you have the ability, because it's so cheap to generate this energy in the middle of the day, you say, well, I'm not going to release it to the grid in the middle of the day. I'm going to save that in my battery, and then I'm going to pump it back into the grid at 6 o'clock when mum and dad get home, fire up the heat pump with the heater, and that energy's in a bit higher demand. So batteries and solar are like the match made in heaven. Yeah, I see, you know, we're already seeing this in New Zealand in terms of the way that solar is dominating the future project space. And Transpower's got a pretty public queue of projects that they've got stacked up, looking to connect to the grid. And I did some numbers about a month ago, and 70% of those projects are currently by capacity are solar at the moment. So we're still going to have a role in New Zealand for wind. It's still going to be an important resource, but it's going to struggle to compete, I think, in the long run with the continual cost of solar, because wind is fundamentally, there's a bit more involved from an infrastructure point of view. You know, these are big machines that, you know, need serious amounts of concrete in the ground in order to grow them. The beauty of solar is it's so scalable. It's like Bitcoin in a lot of ways. You know, you can put one panel on your roof, or you can put a million panels on a farm and have a massive project. So, you know, the scalability and the ease of deployment are again, some more of its superpowers. So yeah. I'm going to have to get somebody to take me down from my solar high, I think. But that's my little rant about, you know, how optimistic I am about the solar space.
I think it maybe comes back to narrative a little bit. I think just maybe within the Bitcoin space, there has been some criticisms of maybe wind more than solar. And mm-hmm. I think there are some valid arguments there. However, it is also maybe being postured that those arguments are being put out there because the alternative is shutting down perfectly fine nuclear power plants in places like Germany and even Japan. I think they've been talking about, you know, retiring some of these plants and a few other things which are driven by misaligned incentives. But having an open and honest conversation about this stuff. I mean, for example, I've moved into a new apartment here and we've got solar on the roof, and this is the first time I've ever experienced it. And I was actually, my jaw dropped, and this is a bit naive, but I realized this is all of these new apartments in Japan that have these solar panels on top, and they're selling into the grid, and we actually get a rebate.
Yeah.
As just, you know, and this is just a rental, but we're basically paying, you know, we don't use much power here, and so we're getting paid by these things that are on the roof.
Yeah.
You can have them anywhere, you know, like if you just any flat surface, you know.
That's the revelation for solar is that, I saw an article actually the other day in Germany, it was a little bit clickbaity, but the article was, you know, solar panels are now so cheap that the farmers are using them for fencing, you know. There comes a point where these panels are just so cheap that you just put them everywhere, and it doesn't matter if they're not quite at the optimal angle or they're not quite pointing to the north or the south in the northern hemisphere, because they're just so cheap that you get a little bit of energy from them and they all stack up and you wire them all together and away you go.
I think there's something to explore there in the future, just around the economics of that and sort of stepping out of the mindset. I think there is a defensive mindset that I think is a valid stance, which is that these renewables and this push for these renewables by often by governments, and it sort of feels like it's a bit of a thing, and Bitcoin's like, hey, just leave me alone, I want my diesel, you know, and my coal.
Yep.
But actually, you know, unpicking the truth that there is maybe a synergistic relationship there, and how it could work for somewhere like New Zealand, which has got huge amounts of, you know, open, you know, sparsely populated land. You can run sheep under these things, you know, you don't need them to be offsetting productive industry, right?
No, absolutely. And the cool thing, just to touch on that, because the valid criticism of solar and wind in other countries is it's been heavily subsidized by the government. And I think that's, you know, you can make the argument that, you know, we should be subsidizing these industries to try and bootstrap them up. I don't want to get too far into that rabbit hole, but one thing that we can, if you take the other viewpoint in New Zealand, we can be quite proud of is that we haven't subsidized solar in New Zealand at all. I don't think there's ever been a dollar that's been given to by the government, by the public sector towards solar deployment in New Zealand. And so it's the industry here, and it's just, you know, it's still in its infancy, but it has bootstrapped itself up from the ground with no assistance from government. And away it's going, it's just taking off, you know, and again, it just comes down to that. At some point, there comes a time where mum and pop say, oh yeah, it makes sense to put them on my roof. And, you know, we're seeing that, you know, play out around the country at the moment.
Well, hey, my dad's just put some on his roof, so.
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing that, man. I didn't know that, because I mean, that is a criticism that, you know, the government, you know, the taxpayers are paying for these things. And maybe in the case of wind, is that true, or do you know?
I mean, there's definitely been some involvement in the wind industry by the government. Probably more, I'm not sure, I don't want to sort of step out of line with the facts here, but probably not so much in directly funding projects, but more on the research side. And, you know, I know the Brooklyn wind turbine, I think, was partially potentially government funded or even ECNZ back in the day. So, but even wind, I don't think you'd point to the story of wind in New Zealand and say that where it is now is a function of investment that the government's made in the technology. I don't think you can say the same thing for overseas places. You know, I know Germany has poured a lot of money into wind and solar for their own reasons, but in New Zealand we've tended to stay away from the subsidy approach in the energy space, which In recent times anyway, and certainly in my career. And that's, I think that's been a positive.
Yeah. So I guess coming back to something you talked about though, with the, you know, there's a lot of projects that are underway, there's a lot of things happening. Would you say though, New Zealand's ability to actually build stuff out in terms of pure just manpower, you know, resources, equipment, these kinds of things, are we heading towards a project crunch?
Yeah, it's going to be a really interesting few years as some of these projects, what we say, shake out, because it's one thing to come in from overseas, and we've seen a little bit of this overseas developer, and come and find a nice paddock in the countryside and say, I'm going to build a solar farm here. But then any number of obstacles will get in the way of bringing that project to reality, right? So, you know, the first one might be as simple as getting consent from the regional council or the local council, or the next one might be, oh, you found a great paddock, but you're kilometers and kilometers away from the nearest transmission infrastructure or grid infrastructure. So, you know, that's going to sink the project because you can't afford to do the new line to get it in. And then the other one that sometimes is a bit of an afterthought that people think about is the, you know, who's going to buy the energy? A lot of people are thinking, oh, I'll just sell it on the open market. We have an open market in New Zealand for energy. But one thing we know about markets is when they get flooded by every solar farm in the country, for example, generating energy at the same time, which they will, they're all coincident, it's just going to kill the price at that time of day. So unless you've got a buyer, like some kind of power purchase agreement for that energy, then that could also sink the project. So there's those three things. And then the one you touched on is, you know, do we have the labor force and the people to actually build these projects? And that's still an open question for me. I think New Zealanders have proven themselves over the years to be pretty good at, you know, getting on with stuff and responding to a need. And I think to a certain extent, the market will take care of that. You know, another really positive thing about solar is that it's not difficult to construct. It's like a giant Meccano set, basically. You're doing up bolts. And I'm simplifying it a little bit, but, you know, there's not very elaborate foundations and these types of things to build it. So it actually creates a lot of meaningful work for people and sort of semi-skilled work that people can do that, you know, has real value to the economy. And I see that it's a real enabler for, you know, some of those lower wage jobs potentially to come in and provide resource to help build these projects. So I think in summary, yep, we're going to get a little bit of a shaking out of projects. Some of them will fall over for various reasons, and the best projects will emerge from that. And I think the labor problem will, to a certain extent, take care of itself with the market and, you know, wages and that type of thing. So,
yeah. Yeah. Well, I think, no, thank you, Brad. And I think at a high level, maybe it could be cool to close on, I guess, some of the visionary leadership side of things, because I actually had a friend working in the industry organization around civil infrastructure. And I know sort of from working with him and talking to him that there's a huge lack of, you know, there's a real labor shortage for civil engineering and civil infrastructure, whether it's just, you know, manual labor or more skilled engineering, yep, project management stuff. And, you know, you've got, I don't know how many, you know, a handful of companies, one of them that looks like it's on the ropes, who actually build scale, you know, infrastructure at scale. And again, I compare that with my experience here in Asia, and you've got just world leading mega corporations, you know, who can just put 20 people on it, where in New Zealand it would be one person, you know.
Yep.
And so what does that look like? I mean, maybe does this come back to sort of our engagement with policymakers and looking at immigration, looking at kind of some of these policy settings that are relevant to these things? And I guess in your work, what are the vehicles that you've seen for industry and government to kind of communicate about these issues?
I mean, engineers love a good conference, right? I'm a little bit conferenced out, to be honest. I've been to quite a few in the last sort of few years, and talking's great and sharing ideas and collaborating and stuff. I you know, I love that. It's good stuff, and it's what we're doing today, right? But you know, at some point, you you get a bit fed up with just talking, and you want to you do the work, you know, the proof of work, and get in there and get stuck in. And I think as a people, I think New Zealanders are, that's something that we can leverage. You know, the people are hardworking generally. They're motivated, smart people who are connected to the country and the earth. And we like to get on and work hard and do a good job. And I think, you know, if we provide an opportunity for people to do meaningful work, they'll come, they'll respond. I mean, people are looking everywhere you look in the world at the moment, people are looking for meaning, right? In their life and their personal lives and their work lives and everything. And, you know, and you see it when people create meaningful projects and meaningful work, you know, it's like a magnet drawing everyone in, right? And it's, and I think we have great potential in New Zealand to create really meaningful work and really meaningful projects. And I think the energy space is, you know, one way that I'm optimistic and hopeful that we can leverage to help make that happen.
Yeah. No, thank you, man. And what you said around that search for meaning, that's sort of, I think of, was it Viktor Frankl, man's search for meaning, you know? And I mean, we are going through some really trying times. I think it's a psychological battle over anything. Sort of, what do we do now? And it's all connected, because we're talking about AI and the sort mm-hmm. of, you know, as far as I can see, any kind of just process work that would have traditionally been considered a job is going away. You know, those people will retire out and move on or be made redundant. But I think now, as I said earlier, I think we get to do the real work. You know, this kind of computer sophistry, you know, kind of data entry stuff can go away. And I know firsthand for me, you know, I'm actively looking at what I can be involved in, you know, and what I can build. I couldn't think of anything more exciting than working on like a major energy project in any capacity, you know. And I mean, how do you get that out there? You know, like...
I mean, there's lots of ways. There's lots of different roles for different types of businesses in the space. You know, obviously I'm in the consulting space. You know, we do design work and, you know, feasibility type stuff as well. But, you know, there's going to be roles and for the contractors who do the building, subcontractors who, you know, just are employing bodies basically to help build these things. And then, you know, you come to the media people, and you know, they've got a role in I said they're going to call you a media person. Cody, are you a media person? A media personality?
I don't want to be associated with the mainstream media in any capacity, but I think the high level though, Brad, is I see the connectivity between people, because as I say, I have a lot of conversations with people, and I can connect the dots and say, oh, okay. You know, I bumped into a guy here in Kamakura who's working for a very large oil and gas company, and we've been chatting about Bitcoin mining, and he's very very interested and very knowledgeable about oil and gas, and didn't know anything about Bitcoin, so I gave him a bit of an overview, and you know, that's a connection that I was able to develop, and I see connections with what you're doing with all the people that I've spoken with, and it's sort of like, it's sort of this movement, this kind of builders revolution or something, where, you know, we're sort of putting down the computers and the bullshit and saying, all right, it's time to actually make some stuff again. The world, I don't know, it's like there's like a calling, it's sort of like a zeitgeist almost. And you see it, you know, I was reading through Riot, you know, the Texas Bitcoin miners, and just reading their investor report. And man, just the scale of their facilities and what they're doing, man, that is so fucking cool. That for me, that's the new tech sector. You know, everyone 5-10 years ago, everyone wanted to work in tech. Everyone wanted to become a programmer and a developer in San Francisco. Yep. Now I'm like, man, is everyone going to want to start building infrastructure? Because that's way more fulfilling, way more interesting.
Oh.
You know,
I mean, that's a world that I'd love to be part of.
A renaissance of of building
renaissance
stuff.
Of infrastructure. Yeah.
Bitcoin renaissance. Well, look, man, that's really exciting. I'm really it's really interesting to learn about what you're working on, and I hope in the future you mentioned at the beginning this new Bitcoin mine that's coming online soon. I hope we can talk more about that in the future. Yeah.
Yeah, hopefully I'd love to. I've been trying to connect with the gentleman who's setting it up, and he hasn't been able to get him just yet. So I'm quite keen to have a good conversation with him and find out, you know, a bit more detail about the project. But when I do, and when he's comfortable sharing some details, I'll be sure to shout it from the rooftops.
Yeah. Cool. All right, Brad. Thank you so much for your time on a Tuesday evening. I know it's a bit late there, but we'll hopefully keep in touch. And thank you very
definitely,
much.
Definitely. You know, thanks for the opportunity to come back and talk again. I really enjoyed it. And I always feel like there's so much more to talk about when we catch up. But yes. We'll have to leave it for another time. Awesome.
No worries. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I do hope you enjoyed the show. I am Cody Allingham, and that was the Transformation of Value. If you would like to get in touch, please send me an email at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com and I will get back to you.